Hi, this is Mackenzie. If you listened to our last episode, you know that it's been a while since we recorded. This episode about Hellraiser was recorded in April of 2023, so not quite a year ago, but we're getting there. But we're back in the swing of things. Our next episode will indeed be the episode we mentioned at the end of the Hellraiser episode, and it will be more current, recorded in January, so 2024. Woo. But please enjoy this episode and thank you for listening and sticking with us. Hello and welcome to Chick Flicks. I'm Mackenzie Chapman.
And I'm Bridget Hovell, and today we are talking about Hellraiser from 1987.
But first, let's catch up. What are you into, Bridget?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So I felt like I had so much that I was into, and then I started thinking long and hard about it. And I was like, here's what's risen to the top. I'm really into this new album by the artist known as Fever Ray. Karen Dreijer, I think is how you pronounce their last name. And the new album is called Radical Romantics. And Karen was formerly a part of the band The Knife, which they performed in with their brother, which is kind of cool that it was a sibling duo. And The Knife is like very iconic early indies electronic music. And they've done a few solo albums under the moniker Fever Ray. And this is their most recent album. It just came out. And a lot of it is about being a parent, which I found really interesting. They have one
Cool.
song that was produced by Trent Reznor, actually. That's about their kids' bully. And it's kind of like this hardcore song. And the lyrics are basically like, this is for Zachariah, who bullied my kid in high school. We know where you live.
Oh my
And
God.
the song is called Even It Out. And it's basically like, I'm gonna fuck you up.
Big Tar vibes.
Yeah, absolutely Big Tar vibes. And they're just like really playing around with like gender presentation in a lot of the imagery for this album. They've been dressing up in this kind of frightening looking visage, which is like kind of looks like a character from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's like a bald person with like long hair on the sides. And
Okay.
I think it's supposed to be kind of like childlike as well. But I'm really enjoying it. They have such a distinctive musical sound. They utilize Caribbean like steel drums a lot. So it just always sounds like a Fever Ray album when you're listening to it, because I don't really listen to anything else like that.
Cool.
Yeah. Spring soundtrack. I recently read two books by the author Leah Bardugo, who wrote Shadow and Bone. Have you watched or read any of those? I feel like we've talked about this.
I have watched the first season and part of the second season. I feel like I'd probably enjoy them more as books.
Okay. I wanted to watch them.
I also like fun to watch. I haven't made it through the second season yet because I sort of just threw it on in the background, but it is like, I mean, sometimes you just want a fantasy thing, and I'm all for making more of Shadow and Bone, the
Yeah, I
show.
hope that Netflix doesn't cancel it
Me too.
before I get into it. But this author also has been writing this series. It's going to be a trilogy. The first two books are out. The first one is called The Ninth House, and the second one, which I finished a couple of weeks ago, is called Hellbent. And it's an adult fantasy series, which is such a funny distinction because I wonder how different these books are from her other books, like in terms of content. But they follow a young woman named Alex Stern, who is given this crazy opportunity after basically being like a high school dropout drug addict, to get a full scholarship to Yale University because she can see ghosts,
Hell yeah.
which are called grays in the universe. And she is basically recruited by this secret society at Yale that is tasked with monitoring the other secret societies at Yale. And so this author, Leigh Bardugo, actually went to Yale in like the 90s, I believe, and was one of these secret societies, which are real, but this book is like proposing that supposing is a word I just made up, that what if these like secret societies like actually did perform magic, and they all have kind of different magic that they keep in control of. Like one is called Scroll and Key. One of them that has lots of like, I think like finance bros in its alumni. They do this ritual where they like abduct a homeless guy and then cut open his insides to kind of like read the stock market through his like basically like
okay,
tea leaves. Yeah. And so the house that Alex belongs to is called, I've already forgotten, Leith. And their job is to basically monitor all the activities of the other secret societies and make sure that they're not like abusing their magical powers and not like doing too much harm to like regular people. Like when they do that to a homeless guy, they have to like stitch him up and make sure he doesn't remember any of it.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And so it basically is about Alex trying to fit in at Yale, even though she's come from this like radically different background, trying to juggle her studies with her extracurricular activity being in this secret society. And it has like a slow burn romance, which has been very slow so far. And it's good. I really enjoyed the first book because I thought the author was making a lot of interesting connections between like magic and power and like the privilege of these like very old universities. Basically, like it's like pointed out a lot that people kind of hoard magic the same way they hoard other resources and use it to kind of the people who are like victims of that hoarding are, you know, not allowed like the upper echelons of these universities. The second book was not as good, unfortunately. I feel like it was very like repetitive, but I'm hooked and I have to figure out what happens in the third book now. So I'm staying on this ride. Awesome. I really do hate that the main character's full name is Galaxy Stern, which to me is like such cringe, like fantasy writing sometimes. And like that kind of works because in the universe, she's like, no one calls me that. Like it's my mom named me that. It's so embarrassing. But then they'll whip it out every once in a while. They'll be like, her name's Galaxy. Oh, it's so embarrassing. And then the final thing I'm into recently is this book, Fight Night, by Miriam Towes, who wrote Women Talking, which was recently adapted into a movie. I loved this book. It's written from the perspective of this 9-year-old named Swiv, who lives with her mom, who is pregnant, and her grandma, and her dad has recently left the family. And she's an incredibly like precocious little girl. I've seen it compared a little bit to Kill a Mockingbird just because she has such a like strong perspective. And it's primarily about Swiv's relationship with her grandmother, which is so sweet. And it's just like a very sweet story about like three generations of women who they all love basketball, especially the grandmother, and they all watch basketball together.
That's so fun.
Yeah. And it's just a sweet little book about Swiv kind of like preparing for her mom to have another kid and trying to make sense of like what's going on in her parents' relationships. And her grandmother left kind of like this abusive religious sect. And a lot of it is just basically like some sage advice from grandma, but I really enjoyed it. It was very sweet. Enough about what I'm into. Mackenzie, what are you into?
I mean, you could go on. I am sold. I want to read and listen to everything you just talked about. I have Ninth House. I really want to read it because I used to work in New Haven.
Yeah.
And I think it would just be fun to...
A lot of it is like New Haven history too, like the history of the city, which is very, very interesting. Yeah.
So similarly to you, I was also like, I'm into so much stuff. And then thinking about it, I was like, these are the things that I want to talk about. So
yeah.
The first is the book We Are Never Meeting in Real Life by Samantha Irby. And Samantha Irby is one of those authors that I've seen a lot of, and her books are pretty distinctive. Like it's like a bright colored book with an animal on it usually.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I've always sort of been turned off by the cover. I guess I didn't know anything about them. I was just sort of like, this book is popular. I don't really want to read it because it seemed to me like, I guess I had this preconception that it would be like self-helpy, but it is not that at all. I was just wrong. She was a guest on Normal Gossip, the podcast that we both love. And then I was like, okay, let me check this out because she was very funny on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it on Libby and I listened to it and she's reading it and she is so funny. She's a comedian and a writer. And the writing is genuinely like very beautiful. She's a great writer. She's like I said, she's fucking hilarious. And they're all like essays about her life, about like dating, about growing up with a like her parents were very older.
Mm-hmm.
They had her when they were quite old. So it's about like talking about aging parents, the death mm-hmm. of her dad, like being queer and sort of like figuring that out, and also about a cat named Helen, which so Samantha Irby like worked in a like vet hospital, and so some of her essays are like centered around that or reference that. And when the thing where I was like, this is fucking good, was when she was describing this cat, Helen, who she ended up adopting, but she was like, this cat is disgusting. Like, it's like so sick. It's so gross. I hate this cat. This cat is a demon. And she describes it like catching Helen like levitating because of the devil once. So it just like injected like this, and maybe this is like overly dramatic, but like magical realism into it in like a funny way. But I was like, she's fucking so smart and like so interesting. And it's nice because she has like a bunch of other books. So I'm excited to read more.
Keep going through.
Yeah.
I've never read anything about hers, but I've heard so often, you know, and that they're really good and very funny, and they're always on lists that I see.
Exactly. Yeah. I had like no idea, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, dang, I just like had no idea what this was about, but she's really good. And yeah, definitely recommend it. And then the second book I am into is When We Cease to Understand the World by Benjamin Labatut. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it is a novel, but it reads like nonfiction, kind of. It's almost like you're following someone down a Wikipedia rabbit hole. So a lot of it is based in fact, but there's really no way to tell what's real and what's fictitious. And its through line is following different scientists throughout the 20th century as they sometimes unwittingly, sometimes intentionally invent terrible things like chemical weapons or like mysterious equations that could destroy the world. So it begins talking about like cyanide and gas that was used in gas chambers in World War II. Then it continues on to like talking about black holes and like the quantum realm.
Ooh.
And one of the things that is a through line between all the scientists are they have like these terrible skin diseases. It's like, I joked to Ian, read this too, and I joked to Ian while reading it that like one thing you got to know about people studying the quantum realm is that their skin is going to be rotting.
Like worse than eczema?
Yes, like worse than eczema. Like they have like open sores and like just gross, painful. So it's almost like body horror a little bit.
Yeah. Wow.
And like it's just interesting as you read. I haven't actually finished it, but the more you get into the book, you're able to like draw connections between like these past scientists and the scientific discoveries and like drawing them together. And I definitely think that this author could convince me to become like a conspiracy theorist if he wanted to.
Ooh.
But it's definitely been like a very interesting and unique read. I've been enjoying it. So I recommend that. One of the people on the back said something like on the back cover of the book, said like, it's a dystopian novel about our current
situation.
The world.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a good way to describe it. So also that. And then the third thing I'm going to talk about is, yes, Ted Lasso. I'm watching it. And you know what? A lot of the show does not work for me.
Mm.
But this last episode, the most recent one, which is they're in Amsterdam. We're recording this on Saturday, April 22nd. I really enjoyed it. It The show, its strengths are the relationships between the central characters. And I think that this season especially, it has deviated from that quite a bit. And introduced like more characters or just sort of gotten lost and not been reinforcing or spending much time with the central characters and their interactions with each other. And I think that when it does do that, the moments where it does have, like, for example, like Ted Lasso and the other coaches like in a room together talking to each other, like those are some of my favorite moments. But this episode in Amsterdam, it is sort of a return to that, and it kind of captures that feeling of like staying out all night and you feel like the world is like magical and you're like very present and excited by new experiences and like making these like fleeting but genuine connections with another person. It really, it captured that super well, which I think is unique, and I just really enjoyed it. It was like sort of a return to form a little bit, but also a break from it because they're in this new location. And it explored maybe maybe new relationships, but in a way that was familiar to the core of the show, which is like very heartwarming. So I really liked it.
Yeah, I've heard that people are not as sold on this season as previous seasons. Is this the last season too? Question mark?
I don't know.
I think so.
It's almost like I wish they played more soccer, because I think that, well, also because I'm into soccer these days, but yeah. I think like when that it just is like tighter. It's not like like, I think the weakest storyline for me has been this like Keely character, which she was like in the first season dating one of the soccer players, and then in the second season she was dating another one of the soccer players, and then in this third season she's not dating she is dating someone, I won't spoil it, but she is dating someone that's not on the soccer team. She has her own PR agency. She's like the PR person for the team.
Okay.
But she doesn't interact with any of the like core characters really, except for the owner of the team. And even then, it's like there's distance between them. So I'm like, I don't know.
What the heck? Yeah.
It's just losing itself a little bit. But the Amsterdam episode was really nice. I really liked it a lot.
Nice. Well, to continue a streak of talking about warm and fuzzy things that are nice, let's jump into Hellraiser.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, Kenz, this was your first time watching Hellraiser, right?
Yes. I didn't know anything about it, except about Pinhead, the character, like as an image, essentially. Yes. Like not what Pinhead was about.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Just this character, what they look like.
Yeah, he's iconic. I can remember being in Blockbuster as a kid and like walking by the Hellraiser DVD and being like, whatever that is so fucking scary.
Yeah.
Who knows what that movie is about?
Yeah.
So Hellraiser is about this guy named Larry who has a wife named Julia and a brother named Frank and a daughter named Kirstie, and they're a happy nuclear family. Larry and Frank are estranged. We are told in flashback that Frank and Julia had an affair. And the action of the movie begins with Larry and Julia moving into a new house where they discover that Frank has been squatting, but he is currently gone because we have seen in the first scene of the movie that he has purchased this little puzzle box and in his quest for kind of a escalating drive to encounter the world's most erotic, pleasurable things. And he runs into this group called the Cenobites. And what are the Cenobites like?
I fucking love these guys. They are like pretty disgusting, I would say, humanoid creatures that all have like some sort of gaping wound. Usually Sinhead is like the leader, essentially. Mm-hmm. But then there are some other ones that one has like the mouth of the alien from Aliens that like is like chatter, like teeth chattering.
Yeah.
Another looks sort of like a worm. Yeah. And another one has like a throat cut open that looks like a vulva.
Yeah, vulva, very vulva.
What else? I think there are more.
I think there's four in this. So it's Pinhead, okay. The Chatterer. I have their names written down here. Pinhead, the Chatterer, Butterball. Who wears sunglasses, which is so funny.
Yeah.
That he's wearing sunglasses.
Yes, so funny.
Like, cracks
that's
me up
one
every
that
time.
Kind of looks like a worm.
Yeah, he's like, he's a little wormy. And then the Chatterer, who you mentioned, and then the Female, which is a disappointing name.
I guess originally named Deep Throat, which is better.
Oh, shit. Yeah, it's so much better.
Because of the vulva in the throat.
Oh, I love that. Okay. Yeah. I was looking up the Hellraiser wiki for the list of all of the different Cenobite names, and they kind of sound, some of them sound like drag queen names, you know?
Yeah.
Like their personas.
That would be actually so sick if there was like a drag queen that made her persona after Hellraiser and just like had a very like goth, like gross body horror stuff.
I mean, like, we'll get into that, but like Hellraiser is like making those connections on its own. You know, it's not like we're 100%. Making that jump. And Pinhead is also, that's like his name that he was given by the fandom. He is actually known as the Hell Priest or the Priest.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. Yeah. Which is funny. Yeah. He's like notoriously known as Pinhead now. But this movie is based on a novella by Clive Barker called The Hellbound Heart. And it was adapted by Clive Barker. He directed it and wrote it, which I can't honestly think of many other authors who make that leap and have that. Yeah.
Successfully too. I this was not an amateur to me. Mm-hmm. I was very impressed with the filmmaking.
Yes. And this was his first film ever. He talked a lot in like interviews about how patient everyone was with him as he figured stuff out. Mm-hmm. The first scene where Frank appears in the rain to meet Julia was the first scene that Clive Barker had ever filmed, and they were using it as like a test.
Oh my god.
Like to see if like if the footage was good. Uh-huh. And then they were like, we'll use it. It was good.
Yeah.
So that's so crazy. And it really lends this movie kind of like a DIY quality to the special effects that I think have made it so beloved.
Yeah. The special effects were very DIY, but like even just like, well, I guess maybe this is a credit to his team too. Like the editing was very impressive. I felt like the lighting, it was just a great, it was like a great production, I have to say.
Yeah. And it's one of those things I think we've talked about so much with special effects too, where it's like transforming or like creating something that looks as realistic or photorealistic as possible doesn't necessarily like improve its ability to scare you. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of scenes or like cuts to like a blade or a hook entering flesh. And it's clearly not actual human flesh, but it doesn't have to be like a one for one representation to make you like cringe or like squeal.
Yeah.
Like it's totally. Definitely, it's not like real human flesh. The blood is very like fluorescent in this movie. And I think it's melted wax at times too. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like a symbol for blood that, you know, you immediately understand what it is, even though it looks so unreal. Yeah. But let's talk about the other characters in the film, other than the pinheads. We have Julia. And what is she like?
Julia is a very confusing character to me.
Yeah.
Because she is at first presented as someone you might be able to, like, initially, first off, like, you're like, oh, maybe I can sympathize with her because she is moving into this terrible house. The
house
when they first enter into it, It has like maggots. You see that Frank was squatting there. It's just like an extremely terrifying, disgusting
hole. I would be like,
hole.
I'm staying at a hotel while you fix up this house, Larry.
Yes, me too. I was shocked that she agreed to move into this house. Yes. So I was at first like, this poor woman. Like,
yeah.
Well, like, don't do this. But very quickly, it is revealed that she has some like secret past with mm-hmm. Frank. She finds a photo of him and rips out the woman in the photo so that she mm-hmm. can keep the photo of him. And she's very cold and standoffish to both Larry and Kirsty, the daughter of Larry. And just in general, kind of cold to their friends too. Just like an unhappy person. So I think like I said, she moved mm-hmm. into this gross house. So like I would also be unhappy. But
yeah,
she's like, I don't really understand why she does the things she does. Like, I don't understand. She's very into Frank, even though he's like rotting flesh. Even in flashbacks when he's like hot, seemingly, I don't understand her attraction to him.
Yeah. She's British. This is kind of a weird thing about the movie is that Julia is British. They filmed in London. But then I was reading that they were forced to change the location, like to say it was in America, which it lends this kind of like weird. You're like, where the fuck are they? Or
yeah,
like some people have British accents, some people don't have British accents. But and Clive Barker is British. And so I wonder if Julia, as like kind of the only noticeable Brit in the movie, too, is supposed to kind of like represent this like very repressed upper middle class British culture.
Yes.
Because that's really all we're given to kind of connect with Julia, is that she is described as being like kind of rigid and uptight. Mm-hmm. We don't have any background. We're just like, oh, okay, maybe like we're just supposed to recognize her as this like part of this like class of people who are pretty prim and proper. Mm-hmm. And that's why she wants to secretly let loose by riding on the crazy
tracks.
Train with Frank.
Yeah. It's almost like she's not a character, she's like a symbol.
Exactly. And they all kind of are like that. Like, yeah. There's not a lot of backstory for anyone. We don't really know what Frank and Larry's deal is as brothers. Mm-hmm. We don't know why Frank is the way he is. We're just kind of, and I read the novella, but a long time ago, and I can't really remember if they give you more to go on. I do remember the major change they made for the movie, and this is interesting that Clive Barker was like in charge of his own adaptation, was that in the book, Kirsty is their friend. She's like a friend who's into Larry. And it's kind of like, oh, I hate Julia. Like, I'm like Larry's like best girlfriend. And
interesting.
Yeah. So it's like more of like they're like more like a like sexual competition.
That's interesting because I did at the end of this movie felt like Larry / Frank at that point. Because Frank takes over Larry's skin at the end. Spoiler.
Yeah. Brothers.
And Julia were trying to seduce Kirsty.
Yes.
So they were like another layer of like taboo to it.
Yes, definitely. There's definitely like the threat of incest in the last third of the movie.
Yes.
And even before that, Kirsty is very loving to Larry, her dad, and very like protective of him. And they go out to dinner together and she calls him daddy.
Yeah. The daddy thing.
I know the daddy thing.
Very weird.
Very, very
and,
weird.
Well, I was going to say, there's also a lot of like rape stuff in this.
Yes, there is. There is a lot of rape stuff in this
movie.
Did you catch this scene where I think to kind of distract him, Julia starts initiating sex with Larry and then is laying in bed and sees Frank, who has like kind of been reanimated at that point to be mostly like on his feet and walking around, even though he's like fleshy and terrible. Frank approaches the bed and is like threatening to kill Larry behind Larry's back. And so Julia, while like kind of beginning to have sex with Larry, starts crying, no, stop, no. And Larry doesn't stop for like a long time.
I did note that. And it's the same, honestly, the same, and he gets mad at her.
Yeah, he's like, I don't get you.
Yeah. And the same thing happens when she seduces men to bring them back to for Frank to kill. And that, like,
she's not actually wanting to have sex with these guys. Mm-hmm. She's very much like, I am seducing you and to lure you here so Frank can kill you. But when the men pick up on that, they're not picking up on like, oh, this person might be wanting to hurt me. They're like very angry that she is like changing her mind and not wanting to have sex. Yes. It's very disturbing.
It is very disturbing. Those scenes are very upsetting where Julia is luring people into the attic to kill them. And they definitely like kind of turn on its head this idea of like who is like the hunter and the danger in those like sexual situations that people get into at bars, I guess. I also wished that this movie, I know, like book aside, had more of a like a climax between Kirstie and Julia, because they're kind of like set up at the beginning of the film to both be like protagonists. We're most aligned with their perspectives, and we know that they don't really get along, but they don't really have any interactions actually together.
Yeah, you're right. I agree totally. And the way that Julia's death is sort of not a climax,
almost
really.
Like off camera even.
It's I mean, it's makes sense, and it's almost, well, I don't know, it's kind of sad because Frank kills Julia, which is not surprising, but it's also not very interesting.
That's a good way of putting it.
Because, you know, he is a very like selfish and narcissistic character. But I don't know. It could have been. I think like one of the more interesting things about this movie is that Julia was willing to like. It's not that I understood it, but maybe that is why it was so interesting, was that Julia was like willing to do all of this for Frank, even though.
Yeah. It's like Frank is a hedonist and he will do anything to kind of like chase this like sexual high or sadistic high. And Julia will do anything for Frank. Like he's her, you know, greatest drug or whatever.
It is like that. And so I think like it could have done more with that at the end, I guess. Although I guess in a way they both meet the same end, which is like by chasing the greatest high or whatever.
they both
die.
So to go back to the Cenobites, Clive Barker was very inspired by kind of leather culture. He said Pinhead in particular was inspired by a hardcore S&M club in New York where he was watched people get pierced for fun. And the Cenobites are not in that much of the movie. I think they're used extremely effectively. They're kind in basically three scenes, I think. And something I thought about a lot this time around is that they would be so much less scary if they moved very much, but they don't move very much at all. There's one scene where the female kind of like pursues Kirstie through the house, and that's like the most we see them move. And she's very like slow and deliberate kind of in her movements.
I think only knowing that Pinhead, like going into this movie, only knowing that Pinhead would be, I thought Pinhead honestly would be the main villain. And I was so glad that he wasn't, because I think that it makes sense to me that there is like this expansive world beyond this movie. Like, I don't know what any of the sequels are like. I heard they're not great.
I heard they're not great too. Yeah.
But I think there is like so much potential for like good sequels to be made here, because you're only given this little bit of the Cenobites, and they're very like mysterious. Like, you want more, but you don't get it, which is nice. I'm glad I don't get more.
Yeah. And they're almost like impartial too, you know, which is also scary in its own way.
They were so interesting. So the world building was subtle, but it was like, it left you wanting more of it, which I think was well done.
Yeah, and so much of it is how they look too. The actor who plays Pinhead is named Doug Bradley. Apparently, he lives in Pittsburgh. Someone told me that the other day. And he was a friend of Clive Barker and a struggling actor. And apparently he was given the choice. Like, he was asked to be in this movie and they were like, you can be one of the guys moving a mattress or you can be Pinhead. And he was like, you know, like, it seems like it'd be a better move for my career to be the mattress guy because people can see my face and like know who I am. But then he decided to be one of the Cenobites. And he, I think, revived this role in many sequels and kind of became like a cult phenomena on his own, like works the fandom circuit. And he was talking about the first time he was getting in character, he saw his new face. And he said that most of his decisions about playing Pinhead were made there and then. He said he had a sense of power, of majesty, a kind of beauty. His threat is implied. Look at what I did to myself. Now imagine what I can do to you.
Yeah.
And like the fact that Clive Barker was able to kind of make this movie with all of this imagery that he picked up from kind of like queer subcultures at the time and then turn it into a film about these like heterosexual nightmares, you know, is like pretty interesting. And we read this article by Riley Wade in Horror Obsessive about what makes Hellraiser queer. And they write that, you know, at the time this movie came out in the 80s, you know, the AIDS crisis, was ongoing. There was, you know, a lot of, repression under Thatcher's government in, England. A lot of laws criminalizing, you know, homosexuality. And you highlighted this one part, by expressing outright those things which we bury, by speaking the unspeakable, Barker's work, often dealing openly with, among other things, his homosexuality and subversive sexual practices, aimed to highlight the repressive tendencies of our censorious society by a socially conservative establishment.
I loved the Riley Wade's article. The way that they describe Larry is the most milquetoast heterosexual in all cinema, which I just thought was so funny.
Yeah, that's funny.
But they also talk about the Cenobites being these like cross-gendered beings, which I think is true. Like, I didn't even realize the female one, which is named the female, was female, really. They're all very, like, agendered to me.
And apparently their like, pronouns are it.
Oh, my God.
All of their pronouns are, like, it's. Yeah, so.
That is nuts.
In keeping with that, yeah.
I thought, and then what was the one that you I think, didn't you highlight something?
Oh, yes. This part of the article that Riley Wade writes, why do we watch horror if not for that same sadomasochistic urge, which is like a good point about the genre as well, you know, like the kind of like pleasure we get in like frightening ourselves is very apparent in this movie. It's just so cool that Clive Barker was able to make a movie on like a $900,000 budget that became like a huge success. Like, its box office returns were like $33 million, and it was like such a, you know, like strange, weird movie.
That's great. I didn't realize it was so successful.
Yeah.
But it makes sense. Another thing that Riley says in the article is the film becomes sex. It queers the relationship between viewer and screen, which I think, you know, just builds on that, what you already said, which is that like it is like, like us as the viewer, we're also like participating in this sadomasochistic
absolutely
venture.
Yeah. To go back to some of the special effects too, since we've been doing this like little series on practical effects, one of my favorite special effects is this creature called the Engineer, which is like, I don't think you ever like learn these words in the movie. Like, they're all like the fandom has come up with them. And he's this creature who chases Kirstie throughout like the house. And something I really loved about this like creature's design is that you can really work out pretty quickly how they built it. It's a guy, basically his legs are his arms and his feet are his hands. And the creature's mouth is kind of like down near where the person's like crotch would be. And they chase Kirstie through the house, but that doesn't stop it from being like scary or
right.
Like, knowing how it works doesn't diminish that.
I think the same character too is Is that the thing in the tunnel too that's chasing her in the hospital?
Yeah.
That you can see it's on like a dolly in that scene because it's hanging from the ceiling kind of and they're pushing it. And like, I was like, I could see the like literal mechanisms behind this thing, but I am still scared. Like it's still a very scary thing. You're right.
Absolutely. And another thing that worked really well in this movie is a lot of the materials they use in these practical effects kind of like conjure to mind like bodily fluids. Mm-hmm. They used lube at one point when they were kind of doing the scene of Frank coming up from the floor. Mm-hmm. There's like a lot of lube and condoms on the floor. So it's just kind of funny that like the materials themselves have these like sexual uses.
That's so cool. Like practical effects are the fucking best. It's also very beautiful, I feel like. I mean, it's gross as shit, but it's also, there were some like very beautiful shots in this, I have to say. Like there was one, and this doesn't have to do with the effects really, but there is a shot. Well, I guess so. At the hospital with the tiles begin to, the grout between the tiles begins to glow. And you can tell that, I can just like imagine someone getting like very arts and craftsy with that shot. And it was to signify that the like Cenobites were being summoned to Kirstie's hospital room. But it was so striking and beautiful and just also like timeless. Like I think that a shot like that would have been beautiful even now.
Absolutely. Or,
like, it's just inspiring in terms of like you can imagine someone making it. I loved it. Yeah. There was a bunch of stuff like that with like even the gross stuff. So
yeah, they rebooted it last year. I watched like half of the reboot. It was good. I like enjoyed it. The Cenobites had an like pretty amazing update to their look. Still why within keeping of, you know, like the Cenobite tradition.
Was it like practical?
I can't remember. I know that like the Cenobites themselves look, they really are just like a person in makeup, which is also so important too.
Yes.
That it's, 100%. You know, a real person in the room, with all those pins on their face.
I was maybe gonna, I do really like, I forget the guy's name that directed the reboot, Bruckner or something.
Oh yeah.
But he did The Ritual, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, maybe I enjoyed that too. Yeah.
But I really liked The Ritual, but he also did part of VHS, is probably one of our worst. We hated that movie.
Yeah.
He did the short where it was the people breaking into the house that found the VHS tape.
Okay. That was like maybe the least offensive, so.
Yeah.
We'll let it slide. They got to stop rebooting things and naming it the same name as,
I know, it's very annoying.
As the establishing film.
Could have been like Hell Risen.
Yeah.
Or like wasn't Hellbound was another, which I thought they said it, they didn't name it that because they said it would be too negative, but it also is very much like BDSM-y. So.
Yeah, they could have rebooted it as Hellbound. That would have been kind of cool.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Oh yeah, the bound part. So true.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay. Is there anything else we want to touch on for Hellraiser?
I think I'm good.
I think we exercise some demons. To jump into some people who hated this movie, here's our 1-star reviews. This first one is, this is a movie I don't have much to say about. It's bland. The acting is terrible. The acting is not great. I will say that. It's, you know, it's fitting.
Yeah.
The special effects, makeup, and CGI are subpar. I thought that was so funny because there's no CGI in this movie. So maybe that's what your problem is. There's no story whatsoever. The film style is ugly and the characters are annoying. I have heard people say give it a break. It was 1987. To which I say Star Wars was made in 1977. Alien was made in 1979. The Fly was made in 1986. All of which are miles ahead of Hellraiser in every aspect. But I feel like this movie is a low budget film. Like, it's unfair to compare them. First of all, I think the effects are good. And second of all, it's like unfair to compare them.
Yeah, I think it's funny because this person does, I think, mostly have a problem with it being low budget if they're comparing it to Star Wars and Alien and The Fly. But it is interesting they compare it to The Fly too, I feel like, because The Fly also has similar like themes, effects. I guess, in terms of body horror and effects, like you said.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I agree that like the story and characters aren't very like compelling, but the ideas are.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Absolutely. I agree with that point of yours.
The second one star review is Hellraiser isn't scary in any real sense. It's not a movie that makes you twist and turn in bed. It doesn't make you think. It's just disgusting, like finding someone's hair in your food. You're not sure if you want to finish it.
I mean, if you find it disgusting, it's giving you an emotional reaction.
So. Yeah, so it doesn't make you think. You just don't want to encounter it because you're like scared of it.
It's like the food disgusting test we took.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I'm proud to say that I answered no to the bread mold one, which is the one that has been getting the most pushback.
I said no to that too. I'm like, right up. Because also, like, not to sound like privileged or anything, but like bread, you could just get new bread, you know?
Well, I think too, like, yeah, people are like, the bread one you should say no to. Like, it is genuinely like unsafe to
yes,
do it
exactly.
Because bread is like soft or porous or whatever. So the mold can just like spread through it. Or cheese, hard. You can cut
hard.
It off and
yeah.
eat it.
Cheese
which
is mold.
I said yes to that one.
Yeah,
I was like, sure, I would cut off. Okay.
Absolutely, I would.
Off topic now. But
yeah.
Throw out the bread. Throw out moldy bread. Moral of the story.
I was thinking about the food disgust test last night because I was at this event where there was like an open buffet and a lot of the food went unused. So we were like packing up some of it. And I was like, ooh, just that strangers were like kind of breathing on the food. I was like, I don't want it anymore. You know?
Yeah. And like sitting out for many hours.
Sitting out for a while. Other people I don't know interacting with it. I was like,
It would depend for me what the food was.
Yeah.
I guess.
That's true too. That's true too.
Yeah. What should we talk about next time?
That's such a great question. I thought of a good movie, but I can't remember what it was, like another practical effects movie.
One thing that we have in our list is The Thing.
Oh, yes. That was it. That was it.
Was it The Thing?
It was The Thing. Yes.
All right. Should we do that?
Let's do The Friggin' Thing.
Okay. Let's do The Thing.
We're friggin' doing The Thing. Let's do The Thing. I did a thing.
We're like the who's that girl from the BAFTA awards or whatever,
Ariana DeBose.
Yeah, we're basically
Angela Bassett did the thing. Kurt Russell did the thing. John Carpenter did the thing.
John Carpenter did do the thing. Chick Flicks is researched and written by Bridget Hovell and edited by Mackenzie Chapman. Many thanks to Tim Grieve Carlson for our music. Stay tuned for our next episode where we will cover John Carpenter's The Thing.
The Thing. You can follow Chick Flicks on Instagram and Twitter at Chick Flicks Pod and email us at chickflickspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Bye.